It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, our noisy lives of family meeting. Back in the 90s, Mayor Giuliani created a quality of life hotline and started counting complaints. He probably thought the most complaints would be about squeegee men coming up to cars or about other aggressive panhandlers. He talked about the squeegee men and panhandlers a lot in those days as a threat to quality of life. But the number one complaint turned out to be something he never talked about. Noise. Did the jackhammers have to go at all hours? Do the fire engines really need to be that loud to be safe? And can't they squirt some WD-40 on those subway trains? Then Mayor Bloomberg created 311. And guess what? The number one complaint has always been, that's right, noise. Last year, noise complaints were up 30% from the year before to about 260,000. That's 700 New Yorkers every day so bothered by other people's noise that they feel compelled to tell the authorities. Then, of course, there's our own noise, the noise we feed our own ears, the noise inside our own heads. We'll get to that. So today on the Brian Lehrer Show, a family meeting, our noisy lives. Now, city noises are ever-changing. Today's loud city is not the same as yesterday's loud city. We've got some New York City archive noise to play you from the past a little later on. What was the roar in the Roaring Twenties? We will play some examples and talk to a historian of noise. Plus, a call in later about creativity and noise. Do you like it louder or more quiet to get your creative juices flowing? We'll talk to a writer who likes it louder. And we'll talk about noise in your health, including why hearing loss can feel so loud. But let's start today with a story about noise in your life. Tell us a story about noise in your life. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-WNYC. 9692. Tell us a story about noise in your life. Tell us any true story. Maybe it's a story of a noisy neighbor and how the two of you dealt with it. Was it awkward? Did it end badly? Or did it end well and you made a friend? 212-433-WNYC. Tell us a story about noise in your life, today or in the past. Tell us any true story. 212-433-9692. Maybe it's about noise levels in your own home. Do you and your spouse or kids or parents or roommates argue about music or television noise? How are you working it out? Tell us a story about noise in your life. Tell us any true story. 212-433-9692. Did you ever file an actual noise complaint with the city? Did they do anything about it? Did you get relief? 212-433-9692. We'll have some guests later who can help you challenge others about the rude or illegal noises that they make and can help you insulate your home or just insulate your eardrums from unwanted sound. But for now, tell us a story about noise in your life. Tell us any true story. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So as your calls are coming in, I'll start it off with one or two. I grew up in a little house in Queens on a quiet block. Noise was never an issue. When I rented my first apartment in Manhattan, in Chelsea, it was a small studio on the fifth floor of a building at 20th and 9th. That was as high up as I had ever lived, fifth floor. I looked down at the traffic rushing south on 9th Avenue and I thought, well, I won't hear any of that. I'm all the way up here. But when I moved in, I got my rude awakening, and I mean awakening, literally. I was working an overnight shift at the time, and I slept during the day, or I tried to. What I didn't notice when I gave the landlord my deposit was that a section of 9th Avenue right below me had a big pothole with a few of those steel plates that they put over it so the cars don't fall in. And I didn't realize, being a Manhattan newbie, that 9th Avenue and 20th Street was a major truck route downtown to the Holland Tunnel. So when I would go to bed after work around 7 a.m., I would start to hear the trucks going over the metal plates. Ka-chunk, 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 ka-chunk. I learned to use earplugs, and I got by with a lot of interrupted sleep. Ka-chunk, 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 ka-chunk. And I don't know if they ever repaired that pothole, because I ran away from that noise. But in the 9 months I lived in that apartment, no progress was made. Ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk. I broke my lease early and moved because of that noise to an apartment at 100th Street and Manhattan Avenue. Now, it had a Central Park West address. Maybe some of you know the building. Somehow the Helmsleys, who owned the building, managed to wrangle a Central Park West address out of the city for property value purposes, but it was on 100th Street and Manhattan Avenue. My apartment was all the way up on the 18th floor, and I thought, well, I won't hear any of that. I'm all the way up here. And actually, it was much better. Manhattan Avenue was hardly 9th Avenue. But there was a fire station right down the block. So however many times a day, everything else would pause in my apartment while New York's bravest shot out on their trucks to do their solemn duty, and you live and learn. So that's one of mine. Tell us a story about noise in your life. Tell us any true story. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And let's start with Ernie on Long Island. Ernie, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I live in a culturally blended family. It's myself and my daughter. We're Italian-Americans. We speak English. My fiance is Chinese-American. She speaks Chinese fluently. She has her son, Ethan. And I got to tell you, when they start talking Chinese, it's like I'm in the middle of Beijing. And I don't know, it's interesting, I don't know whether it's because I don't understand the language, or I think they just naturally speak when they speak Chinese. They just naturally speak louder. I wasn't sure if it was me or not, and then I watched the movie Captain Phillips with my daughter about a week ago. And when the pirates were screaming at Captain Phillips in Somali, she turned to me and she said, "That's what it sounds like in the house in the morning when you're at work and Hong and Ethan are speaking to each other. It sounds just like that, total mayhem."
So when they speak English to each other, you think they speak more softly than when they speak Chinese to each other?
Absolutely. When they're speaking,
have you
English,
spoken about it? With your girlfriend, is she aware of it? Does she think it's something cultural or anything like that?
Well, you know, I have spoke about it, but more in kind of like a joking way, you know, no real serious conversations.
Uh-huh.
But
right.
Often I joke about how when Chinese is spoken, the decibel level definitely goes up in the house.
All right, Ernie, thank you very much. Anybody else have a story like that? Post to our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Do you think you speak louder at different times, or if you go back and forth between two languages, one versus the other? Any culturally constructed? I wonder if there's socioeconomically constructed speaking volume. Is it a myth that working class people tend to talk louder than people who have college degrees? Jane in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jane.
Doing this morning?
I'm doing great. You have a story about noise in your life?
Oh, yeah. And let me preface this by saying that I have been meaning for some time to get around to writing to the mayor about everything from the volume in New York City restaurants, outdoor concerts, which you can hear for blocks, and even at the YMCA, they exercise classes often have music so loud that the teacher, the instructor, has to wear a headset so she can ramp the volume up so you can hear her instructions. Now, my story.
And you waited. You waited for so long that the mayor changed.
Yeah, right? Well, you know, Sometimes these things happen, but I was really thrilled this morning to hear that you're addressing this. Now, my personal story, I grew up, myself and my sister grew up on a farm in the Midwest, and did not do any agricultural work ourselves, so we were not exposed to the volume of the tractors and so on. But we came to New York back in the 70s, both of us, and she had a significant hearing loss from a childhood infection in one ear. And it was bad enough that if she was lying down and you stood right next to her and spoke to her, and she had her good ear down and the bad one up, she couldn't understand you, so she'd have to turn her head over.
Uh-huh.
And a couple of decades ago, she went to a New York City audiologist and told them ahead of time before the test, this ear is not good. And after they did the tests on both ears, she asked the girl about it, and the woman said to her, your hearing's no worse than the average New Yorker.
Aha. Uh-huh. So the, yes. Well, you know, when we talk to some experts later in the program, that'll be a good question to ask. Do New Yorkers as a group suffer hearing loss because of the din of the city? But Jane, I want to ask you something. Growing up on a farm, you know, I've heard that farm life is surprisingly loud to somebody who comes from the city, that some of the farm equipment, unless it's way out in the field and you're in the house, but if you're, you know, kind of in the proximity of the work that's being done on a farm, sometimes it can be really, really, really loud. Is that your experience?
Well, it's absolutely true. I mean, you can't hear a person very well who's on farm equipment. They have to, you both have to shout very loud. And sadly, as is sometimes the case even with people in New York who are working at noisy jobs, farmers are very, very negligent about their health. When I was growing up, they wore no earplugs. I don't think they do to this day.
Yeah.
No earplugs, no hearing protection.
What's the loudest piece of farm equipment?
Oh gosh, I really couldn't say today because farm equipment has changed.
It would have progressed, but in your experience at the time.
My experience at the time.
You don't have
it. Well, it would be somewhere between tractors and combines.
Right.
But I'd say probably that my father's old secondhand tractors were the worst. but like I said, they weren't concerned about that. They
right.
weren't concerned about sunburn risk. And I noticed my father was not even concerned about pesticides, even though whenever he would come home having purchased some pretty noxious weed killers and pesticides, like atrazine, for example, is a weed killer.
Right, and Jane, I'm going to leave it there, but I get your point. I have a feeling things have changed, at least in terms of protection from exposure to pesticides out there. At least I hope so, and from the little that I know, for people who actually own farms and run farms, I hope people who are migrant workers and folks like that are being protected sufficiently from the pesticides. I hope the workplace standards require that and from the noise. But thank you very much for that story. And that's a revelation to people from the city. I've heard that before, how loud it can be on a farm. When we talk to a guest coming up in just a few minutes who's a sound historian, we'll play some amazing archive sound from New York from the 20s and 30s. And one of the things that we'll learn is if we think today, because it's all modern and wired up, is louder than it ever was before, that may not actually be the case. But we'll hear a few of more of your stories. Any story about noise in your life, any true story, 212-433-WNYC. How about Jacob in Manhattan? You're on WNYC. Hi, Jacob.
I was in my way to cut my hair at the barber and holding the New York Times in my hands. The barber was very, very noisy, talking to everybody. When my turn arrived, I decided I'll read my article while he cut my hair. And he asked me, how do you like your hair to be cut? and I said to him in silence.
Did he take it as an insult? That's your story. Did he take it badly?
No. I mean, now it happened 20 years ago. Now I'm bald, so I don't have to have that problem anymore.
Think of all the money you save on haircuts. Okay. Elizabeth in Williamsburg, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because of loud motorcycles in Williamsburg. They've really become unbearable in the past several years. I've been living in Williamsburg since 2005, and increasingly they've just are out of control, where they rev their engines, they idle, they have these very loud pipes, and there's really no reason for them.
It sounds bad. And so what you've got is a noise complaint, not so much a story. And one of the other guests we're going to have on this family meeting about noise, called Our Noisy Lives, here on the Brian Lehrer Show, we're going to have the leading noise activist, or really anti-noise activist, in New York City, Arlene Bronsoff, later in the show. And we'll put exactly that kind of question to her, among many others: what you can do, what recourse you have, why motor vehicles aren't regulated for noise more than they are, and to what degree they are, especially with respect to motorcycles revving their engines, which is one of the top irritants, I think, in the city in terms of noise. So we will get to that later on. Holly in Manhattan, you have a story.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I really don't know what's the distinction between story and what is happening to my life as a result of noise. I have two incidents which I would like to share with you. One is that I used to have a neighbor who had a lot of partying and smoking and playing trombone, and my complaints did not go anywhere until he went crazy and threw away the trombone from his window, and life got a little bit calmer in the building.
Oh, my.
Can you imagine?
Art gone berserk, threw the trombone out the window.
I knew a guy who was
an artist.
Not really an artist. He would just get high and get on the trombone.
And get on the trombone and riff. But I knew a guy who was a visual artist, and he would make these sculptures.
He would
go up to the top of his building, go up to the roof of his building in Brooklyn.
Oh, dear.
And he had this sort of masochistic, self-destructive streak. Or maybe it was... I mean, did have that, but maybe it was also just his form of creativity. So he'd make these sculptures, and then he would go up to the roof of his building, look to see that nobody was down below, and he would throw them off the roof to destroy them. So your neighbor threw his trombone out the window.
Yeah, he did. But then somebody else moved on top of me. I'm on the fourth floor of a walk-up. And he sounded like really nice guy. But then I kept hearing bang, bang, bang on my walls every night during the daytime. So I called all the neighbors surrounding me and asking them, well, do you have your music on? You know, it's late at night, blah, blah, blah. They all said no. So I thought it must be coming from him. And so I went up there. To make the story short, he is what is referred to as a sound mixer or some kind of a DJ type, which deals with all kinds of musics and so on. And
so he's got the speakers going.
Beating noise from his computer or his...
And are you the only one affected by it, or did the neighbors rally around?
I'm the only one. But look at how interesting this is. I begged him. I wrote him a note. I called up 311. I called up 911. I called up the police. I told the landlord.
And?
Nothing is happening, Brian. Nothing.
Holly, really, you two stay for when Arlene Bronsoff is here in about a half hour, and we're going to find out what your recourse is when nothing happens after you call 311. And as you said, even 911 and the neighbors won't do it. What can people in those situations do? So, Holly, thank you for sharing your story. I've got a trombone story. Can I tell my trombone story? From 2001 to 2004, I lived at Amsterdam and 105th Street. My son was learning the piano. When we moved in, we discovered that we lived upstairs from an apartment with three trombone players, three guys living together, all musicians who played the trombone. the brass. I worried about all the noise from that brass menagerie, but also thought it was kind of cool to hear them practice. And they appeared to take turns, so there were many hours with the sweet sounds of the slide and the big brass bell. It never occurred to me that one of the trombone players would come up and complain about my little kid practicing the piano, which he did. I thought a trombone player, by definition, gives up his right to complain about other neighbors' noise. But that wasn't how it worked. Tell us a story about noise in your life, any true story. Kylie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kylie.
Hi. So I have just recently moved to Brooklyn, but I used to live in Montclair in the kind of downtown area. And I was amazed at the number of noise complaints that I made and my neighbors made, and that people just are not sensitive to that. They think, well, you live kind of in this downtown area, you should be, you know, you shouldn't be complaining about the noise. But I found that people, particularly in the suburbs, don't really know how to treat that area. They just kind of go out there and make noise like it's just a park or something, and it's not. It's a, you know, it's a street.
In Brooklyn?
Well, no, this was in Montclair. I'm reflecting on when I lived in Montclair.
Oh, uh-huh. Right. And was it that people had moved from the city to Montclair? You know the old joke about Montclair. When you're a single person in Manhattan and you live on the Upper West Side, then you get married and you have a kid, so you move to Park Slope. And then you have your second kid, so you move to Montclair.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that, one, when the noise is, when there's not other city noise to block it out, it becomes very loud that, you know, children are playing tag on the sidewalk. But also there was a bar and they would have a DJ, and I just don't think that their windows or buildings were zoned for that kind of noise. And so at night when the street is very quiet in the suburbs, one single bar playing noise makes a lot of noise.
Right. I think somebody's going to back you up here. Stay there, Kylie, because also joining us is Matt in Jersey City. Matt, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Good. Did something like this happen to you?
Yeah, well, as I explained to the screener, noise is certainly inescapable, whatever side of the Hudson you're on. We used to be in Greenpoint, and people would congregate on our stoop because we were the one tenement sort of on a block of row houses, so we'd get drunks and we'd get kids in the summer. The police would never come. You'd scream at them, but are they going to come get us? So when we moved to Jersey City, we decided we wanted to get higher up. And it turns out, you know, you always got to visit the apartment every time of day. People during rush hour flood the zone and just pack the residential streets because they're trying to find any route possible to get to the Holland Tunnel. And so there's always honking and you know, the loud mufflers, and it's quite unpleasant. But I guess that's the cost of living in New York.
So, Kylie, you moved from Montclair to Brooklyn. Matt, you moved from Brooklyn to New Jersey. Kylie, did you actually move to get away from the suburban noise?
No, I didn't. But it is interesting that to move from the city part of a suburb to the suburban part of a city, because I live in Bed-Stuy, and my street is very, very, very quiet. And no one would believe that it's quieter in the city than it is in New Jersey.
And Matt, you had also a counterintuitive experience moving from the city to, well, Jersey City is still a city, but still.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I didn't think necessarily that it would be quiet, but it was kind of, I don't know. I guess we just get really annoyed because it's like, you should stay on the highway to begin with, but at least if you're going to, like, drive down our street at 7 in the morning, please have the decency not to lay on the horn.
Matt, thank you very much. Kylie, thank you very much. And we'll finish this segment by reading a tweet. Someone writes us, "This city of 8 million has nothing on the noise of a Honduran town of 7,000 where I lived. Fireworks, priests, and mariachis at 4 a.m. So coming up next, we'll find out if New York Today has anything on New York of the 1920s and 30s with respect to noise. We'll hear some incredible archival sound that our next guest has compiled, as she is a historian of the meaning of sound. Stay with us. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's a family meeting today, our noisy lives. And here's a question for some of you who have lived a while. We're going to clear the board from those of you who are calling in with your noise stories. We would love you to post them, by the way, to our comments page. People do tell stories there. It's not a tweet, so you can stretch out a little bit if you want to. Tell us your noise stories online in writing at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But for the phones, here's a question for some of you who have lived a while. How have the sounds of the city changed over the course of your lifetime? 212-433-WNYC, if you have any answer to that question. How have the sounds of the city changed over your lifetime? What noises are gone? What noises are new? Maybe you even realized at a certain point, oh, that noise I've been hearing, that didn't exist before. Which are better than before? Which are worse than before? 212-433-9692. And do you think the city is in general noisier than when you were younger, or is it quieter? How have the noises of the city changed over the course of your lifetime? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. And Emily Thompson's with us now, Princeton historian, author of the book The Soundscape of Modernity, and of an amazing website called The Roaring Twenties, which contains a map of New York City with old newsreels that you can click on that contain sounds and noises of New York, mostly in the 1920s and 30s. We'll hear some of them in just a minute. It also lists specific noise complaints of that era, and you can see and hear all of that on her site. We've got a link at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And as I said, we'll sample some of those archived sounds in just a minute. Emily Thompson, thanks for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks very much for having me, Brian.
And before we play some of those practically century-old sounds, you've said that your goal with this audio archive is not just for people to press play, but to recover the meaning of sound, to undertake a historicized mode of listening that tunes our modern ears to the past. Do you think that people hear differently or listen differently in different eras?
I think they do, Brian. And to really understand the role of noise in a culture, you've got to understand both the sounds themselves and that cultural aspect, what happens in between people's ears when they perceive those sounds. And for me, in many ways, that's almost the more interesting side of this challenge of trying to recover the sound of the past.
And so let's listen to one of the clips. This will be a Chinese New Year with Dragon. You'll see the dragon on the video, folks, if you go to the link, and you'll hear some of the news, sometimes news is noise, of people partying in the streets for Chinese New Year. Do you want to set this up for us? Do you remember this clip and precisely what year it is or anything else to help us listen to it well?
Sure. Well, I think that this clip is from 1930, and you're actually hearing in this case what you might consider are traditional noises. I'm sure Chinese New Year celebrations probably sounded much the same way going way back into the past. Chinatown might present a different kind of urban context in which to hear those sounds, though. And in the video clip, there are reasonably tall buildings rising on either side of the street. I think it's Mott Street. And so you can imagine the buildup of sound bouncing off of those building surfaces and sort of creating a kind of sea of sound that the paraders and the crowd is really swimming in as they listen to the drums and the gongs and the shouting and all the wonderful sounds.
And I see that, yes, this was 1930 on Mott Street. Listen. Enough. Why do I think it doesn't actually sound like that today? Like there's something about that time and that they don't do it exactly the same way. Maybe not because it's traditional sound, but I don't know. It had a period sound to me. But let's go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that idea of a period sound might also be a kind of artifact of the recording technology.
Mm-hmm.
We're listening through many layers of media to get us back to the past, and that is sort of added into the original sounds themselves. And just like when we see old sepia-toned photographs, they just make us feel a certain way about the image that we're looking at. There's a sonic aspect of that at play here as well.
All right. Here's another one from your archive. This is going to be the excavation of what was going to be the subway along the Grand Concourse in the Bronx. So this is subway excavation taking place via dynamite. This is going to be a dynamite blast when they were building an extension of the subway on the Grand Concourse. So I guess it was probably the D train, March 8th, 1929. Unbelievable. You would have thought the world was coming to an end. Does it sound like that today as they build the Second Avenue subway? I don't think so.
Oh, well, I'm not sure from down here in pastoral Princeton, but what's pretty remarkable about the video there, too, is while they seem to have held back the pedestrians for a few seconds when the guy actually pushes the plunger to set off the charge, they're soon right back there. So I would hope that any explosions taking place in the city today have slightly more stringent codes for safety and things like that.
Let's do one more for now, then we'll take some calls and then listen to some more after that. This one was fascinating to me when I heard it on the site this morning. And we'll play it, and then I wonder if you can talk about how people preach and how people talk in the 1920s compared to today. This is a Salvation Army preacher in Sheridan Square, Greenwich Village, February 23rd, 1928.
And we declare to you that whosoever will may come and partake of the water of life freely. The Salvation Army believes in old-time religion.
Amen.
Isn't that so?
Amen.
Say hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Praise God for the old-time religion.
The old-time preaching about the old-time religion. Emily, want to talk about that?
That's a great one, too, and the crowd is really kind of responding to his call and response there. Religious speech is a particularly interesting kind of noise, too, certainly in the 20s and 30s. In addition to sidewalk preachers, a lot of people actually wrote in to the mayor or the health commissioner to complain about the ringing of church bells. And anytime anyone did that, they automatically got a form letter that basically said, Constitution, freedom of religion, we aren't going to touch it, just deal with it.
And I think diction is different. You know, people just don't speak exactly the same. You can hear it when you listen to old clips of people on the radio who don't sound like I sound, who don't sound like people coming up today and are brand new in the media sound. People just speak a little bit differently, yeah?
Absolutely. And I think that's a great kind of a side effect of the video footage with the sound recordings that we've got on this website. You can just hear all the different voices of New Yorkers from this era, including a lot of children who just kind of sound like we just imagine the past sounded like. There are different accents. People who might be more in line with Henry Higgins, say, could probably place them in their neighborhoods based on the quality of their voice. But it's wonderful to listen to. And it is different from how we speak today.
All right. We're going to take some calls from our listeners. Folks, if you've lived a while, call in and tell us how you think the sounds of the city have changed over time. 212-433-WNYC. And let's start with Francine in Bloomingburg, New York. Francine, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi,
good. What's your story?
Okay, so there are two sounds that I haven't heard in years from growing up in Park Slope, and they're both from the 1950s. And one of them was back then, a lot of the buildings were still heated by coal. They hadn't all switched over to oil heat yet. And there's just a certain sound of the coal delivery. When the coal, they would run these tin, these galvanized tin chutes into the building, into the basement of the building, and the coal would just go rumbling down these chutes. And it just made this sort of indescribable sort of sound that that kids, you know, as a kid I loved, you know, it's just kind of this rumble, 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 rumble with the little black clouds of coal dust coming through the rivets, which, you know, I haven't seen that probably since 1958 or something.
And thank goodness the kids aren't breathing that stuff anymore.
I know, but, you know, it's, you know, just the sound itself. And as noisy as the city was, that sound stood out to me.
And you had a second one?
The other one was also a city, a very specific city sound, and from the time. And that was before roller skates had these sort of plastic wheels that don't make any particular kind of sound, and all the roller skate wheels were metal, and metal roller skate wheels going over pavement is another very specific sound.
That's a great one too. Francine, thank you. Those are two fabulous examples of how the sounds of the city have changed over time. As we talk with Emily Thompson, Princeton historian, author of The Soundscape of Modernity, and also an incredible website that has a lot of archival audio called The Roaring Twenties. What'd you think of those two examples?
Well, we've got some roller skaters on the website if anyone wants to take a listen. If you go to the map and scroll down to Hamilton Fish Park downtown, there's a wonderful several clips of children's races going on where there are roller skaters and kids on homemade scooters and bicycles along with the cheering crowd. And it's true, those metal wheels on the pavement made a lot of noise.
Now, we played that clip earlier of a Mott Street 1930 Chinese New Year celebration. John in Oakland wants to react to that from his experience. Hi, John.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show.
Thank you.
Having performed on Mott Street for many years in the 90s and early part of this century, the sound of Chinese New Year is exactly the same as it was in the 1930s. The cymbals, the gongs, the drums are exactly the same, with one exception. In the 90s, when Giuliani took the office, fireworks were banned for Chinese New Year. We were no longer allowed to use them, which was an essential part of the lion dance. The dragon was just a prop, but the lion is the dance that you see when you watch Chinese New Year, and it's quite amazing. And that sound has never changed, never. It's amazing that it's one of the few things. And the city is actually quieter now than it has been in my 44 years.
John, thank you so much. And Emily Thompson, do you think that's true? Is the city quieter today than it was in the era that you archive here, 1900 to 1933?
I think that's certainly possible. If you think about what the city was going through in the 20s and early 30s, there were still lots of elevated trains traveling uptown and downtown everywhere. Yet at the same time, the city was beginning to bury some of those lines. So they were doing those explosions that we heard before, excavating to turn elevated lines into subway lines. That's an enormous amount of noise to have all that going on at once. Also, it's the case that a lot of automobiles and trucks did not have mufflers at the time, so they were a lot louder than modern automobiles are today, and that must have had an impact as well.
And I wonder what it would sound like to go back even further before recorded sound. Did you ever read the novel Time and Again by Jack Finney?
No, I'm afraid I haven't.
It's a story of a guy who goes back to 1880s Manhattan from, I think, 1980s Manhattan or 1970s Manhattan. And one of the things that surprises him is how loud it is, with very different kinds of sounds. Like you were talking about how the cars sounded differently back then than they do today with no modern mufflers and things like that. He refers to trolley cars being so loud and other things, but really loud. Do you think there may be any truth to that, that the 1880s could have been assaultively loud?
That's possible, and streetcars definitely were a source of complaint for a lot of people. The period that I study, the 20s, we can't really tell if it was louder than, say, the 19th century, although many people claimed that it was, because it was only in the 1920s that scientists and engineers began to be able to measure noise and kind of quantify loudness for the first time. We have qualitative descriptions to give us a sense of what cities sounded like before the phonograph and before measurements could be made. But it's also the case that one scientist took those new tools and actually determined that a horse drawing a cart was louder than even the loud automobiles of the 1920s. So it raises a lot of questions. We can't really be sure how loud it was back then. But it's also the case that people respond to the familiarity or unfamiliarity of sounds. So when new sounds appear in the soundscape, that can be disturbing, whether they're really loud or not, because you have to kind of process them and fit them into your idea of the city, your sort of sense of the urban environment before you're comfortable with them.
I think Debbie on Long Island has a sound of the city that is gone. Is that right, Debbie?
Yes, it is. When I was a babysitter in the 1960s, early 1970s even, when you babysat, the TV stations would go off the air at midnight, and there was nothing to watch, and there would be this monotone on, you know, after watching the Late Show on Channel 2 or Channel 9, Million Dollar Movie. After it was over, you just heard boo. It was just a monotone sound, and you just see the symbol of CBS or whatever Channel 9 was, or Channel 7, and there was nothing on after midnight, no TV programs to watch. So, of course, you always brought a book with you when you were babysitting.
That might be better than what's on some of the networks overnight now.
Yes.
Oh, that's unfair. Debbie, thank you. That's a great one. Ellen in Nyack, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have the experience of I grew up in Washington Heights in the 1950s, and at that time there was a whole progression of noises, but none of them that annoying. I mean, I remember from the 50s that there were a lot of service noises. There were the noises of the bungalow bar that came down the street and the Dugan's truck that delivered bread and the milkman with his, you know, they still had milkmen delivering bottles of milk.
And Ellen, hang on a second, because Mark on the Upper West Side has a milkman story, I think, from your father. Is that right, Mark?
Yes, from my father-in-law.
What did he tell you?
He would have been 94. He's gone now. But we asked him, what was the biggest technological change that happened every decade? And the first one he mentioned was when the milk carts were originally wooden and metal wheels, and they switched to rubber wheels, that the change from the noise going away was amazing.
That's a great one. Thank you. So, Ellen, you want to pick up your story with the milk?
Milkman? So then it started advancing, and then I remember in the early 60s, the actual noise, it sounds like a cliche, but it actually happened, of these kinds of gangs of guys singing bebop, you know, a cappella in the street under our window, practicing, I guess, at midnight, which was not that much fun.
Do you remember what they sang?
And then I moved back. I had lived away from New York for many, many years, and I moved back to Washington Heights in the 90s. And what drove me crazy at that time was, you know, the demographics had changed. There were a lot of families. I guess it had become mostly Dominican, and a lot of families were up late. There was different music playing, and then the car alarms of the 90s were really, really drove me crazy.
Yeah, and car alarms have not been wiped out, but they certainly have been scaled back. We once did a call-in on this show, what's worse, car theft or car alarms? And it was a little bit of a joke, but certainly you can imagine what the response was when we did that. Thank you. Let's get one more in here, and then we'll play a few more of these archival sounds from the 1920s and 30s from Emily Thompson's site. And Margo in Manhattan, you get the last story here.
Oh, good. Well, I remember horse-drawn milk wagons, and I do remember the sounds of their hoofs. And I remember there were many, many, many more birds in the trees, and you could hear the birds chirping. And the other thing is that people whistled. So I think people were happier.
Really?
Walked down the street.
People walked down the street whistling?
Yes.
Whistling.
Whistling. Whistling a tune, you know?
Has that ever come up before in your experience, Emily Thompson? People whistled more.
Well, certainly in reading the things that people complained about, people weren't complaining about that sound. That would suggest the people who did whistle were pretty good at it, I guess.
Maybe, or at least couldn't whistle with a lot of volume. So let's hear a few more excerpts from your site, The Roaring Twenties, before we run out of time, and then we'll run out of town. These are ferry boat horns heard off of the Hudson River January 24th, 1929. The ferry boat horns don't sound the same today, right?
I don't think so, no. And that's one of the loudest sound recordings we've got on the website. And imagine to multiply that sound by possibly hundreds, maybe even thousands, if you add in tugboats as well, churning up and down the rivers. That was a real problem for people who lived on the far east and far west side of the city.
Next one, Chrysler Building under construction. Union construction workers here talked to a newsreel crew from a long way up on the Chrysler Building under construction on November 20th, 1929. You can hear the city noise below.
Is there a machine that's on?
Yeah, she's on now.
This is Local 60 doing the plastering on the Chrysler Building. What unit of brickway is coming? Three or four different unions on this job.
And one more from the Roaring Twenties site. This is the sound of a noisy curve along the old 9th Avenue elevated subway train sometime in 1929. And you will hear, in addition to the sound of the train itself, that it definitely freaks out a certain other species of being. So, you know, Emily Thompson, it makes me wonder, why are the subways still as loud today as they are? With all the technology that we have now to make things, other things quieter that we've been talking about, wheels of cars and all kinds of things, subways are still really loud.
They are, and it costs a lot of money to make things quiet, and you have to convince people that that's a worthwhile expenditure. So that's the cultural side of the history of noise as well, too.
Your book, The Soundscape of Modernity, has a subtitle, Architectural Acoustics and the Culture of Listening in America, 1900 to 1933. I wonder if you think the culture of listening is different. If your book was called Soundscape of Modernity, and that referred to the modern era in art, 1900 to 1933, is there a soundscape of postmodernity or a way of listening today?
I think there is, and I'm actually kind of trying to address that with the website that you mentioned before. In the digital era, in the internet era, in the era of the iPod, I think there's a sense that sound can be whatever we want, wherever we want, whenever we want. And if you go back 100 years, sound had a very different meaning. It told you about where you were and, you know, the physical environment that surrounded you. They were inextricably connected in a way that you couldn't pull apart. Modern technologies today have pulled that apart to such a degree that I think in some ways we aren't as rooted to our sound world as people had been in the past. It's a very different relationship. There are advantages and disadvantages to that. But what I'm trying to do on the website is, again, not just to let you hit play and say, oh, that's what 1929 sounded like, but try to get your head back into 1929, what the city was like, how people thought, what they thought about, in order to let you listen in the way that people did listen a long time ago.
Emily Thompson, Princeton historian, author of The Soundscape of Modernity, Architectural Acoustics and the Culture of Listening in America, and the incredible website, The Roaring Twenties, with all these archived sounds. You can get to the link for that on our page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. And folks, keep going there, because we can't take any more of these calls with historical noises, changes in the noisescape of the city over time. But I see there are still some stories to tell. So go post how the sounds of the city has changed, what has been lost for better or for worse, and what has replaced it at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Emily Thompson, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show family meeting. Today, our noisy lives, and it will continue after the latest news, live from the WNYC newsroom. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer Show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter, at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer, WNYC. It's a family meeting today on the Brian Lehrer Show, our noisy lives. We have two guests now who can help you deal with other people and businesses who you think should pipe down and can help you insulate yourself through technology and personal strategy to make the intruding sounds a little less intrusive. Arlene Bronzoff, the legendary anti-noise activist and environmental psychologist, board member for Grow NYC, formerly called the Council on the Environment in New York City, and Alan Feierstein, owner of Acoustalog, an acoustics consulting business. Welcome to WNYC. Thank you both for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Brian.
And this is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJO 90.3 Toms River 2, New York and New Jersey Public Radio. And folks, if you want advice on how to deal with the noise issue in your home, your workplace, your neighborhood, call in 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. If you want help with how to deal with other people or with the city agencies that might help, call in. If you want help with insulation, earplugs, white noise versus pink noise, some other color noise, how do we assign colors to sounds? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And some of you know we've been asking on Twitter for the last few days, what are the most annoying sounds in New York City? Some of your responses, and this comes up a lot, you know that emergency exit door in the subway stations? You know that sound that's supposed to provide safety now every time a truck backs up? Somebody wrote in about that. I say to the people who use the subway door, why can't you wait 10 seconds for a turnstile? And in one much retweeted nomination for the most annoying New York noise, one of you tweeted Donald Trump.
You'll have the great pleasure of voting for the man that will easily go down as the greatest president in the history of the United States. Me, Donald John Trump.
But what else is a noise issue in your life that you would like some advice about? 212-433-WNYC for Arlene Bronzoft and Alan Feierstein, who are here to help. Alan, what are some of the most common jobs your company does?
We get a lot of calls from people who have noisy neighbors upstairs. We get a lot of calls from people who have noisy commercial equipment and music downstairs or outside bars, nightclubs, restaurants.
And Arlene, he mentioned from neighbors, and when I look at these stats from 311, which are incredible, hundreds of thousands of calls logged every year to complain about noise, I've seen that about half of them have to do with neighbor noise, right?
Yes. Well, let me tell you, neighbor noise is a major problem, but that is not covered by the New York City Noise Code. A person has a right to a reasonable quiet in his or her apartment. It's called the warranty of habitability. And the complaint has to go to the landlord or the managing agent. You have a contract with your landlord or if you're living in a co-op, it's still the lease. And if you're a reasonable person and you're not just complaining about an occasional drop of a toy every 3 months, then you have the right to the quiet of your apartment, and you should take action with your landlord or with the managing agent, and don't be shy about it.
So that's the first line of defense. If you have to complain, if you can't get relief from the person themselves, is go to your landlord or managing agent.
If you ask nicely and you're reasonable, remember, you can't bring an action against the neighbor above. Your contract, as I said, is with your landlord. And that's the number one complaint that comes to me personally.
What about in a co-op or a condo where you
own? Same thing. Same thing. It is a state law. Warranty of habitability. You have the right to live in your apartment and not be exposed to floors that are not carpeted with people running across them at 11 o'clock at night. And I have helped people with that. And I encourage everyone who listens to make sure that they realize they have this right. Remember, people talk about rights. The right to make noise, well, your right stops at my ear. I have a right to some quiet. And I think people should be more assertive about it and take charge and not just be miserable about it.
Robert on the Upper West Side. You're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
How you doing?
Good. You have a noise problem?
Yes. So the problem is people get these new stereos with these super subwoofers, and they blast them at any time. And the biggest argument I have a neighbor that does the same thing and been told over and over. He says, why don't you get a headset? He says, what good is having a good bass if you have to have a headset?
Right.
And
so,
the bass is unbelievable. I mean, they get up early in the morning because they go to work early, and they put the stereo on. 6:15 in the morning.
Yeah, thank you. And let's see if we can get you one or another way to get some relief. Alan, I think it used to be that when people bought two speakers, one was the left and one was the right. Now you buy two speakers and one is the woofer and one is the tweeter. So there's this unbelievable bass that's being generated. Robert's not the only one with this problem.
You also have the type of music that produces a lot of bass. Hip-hop, even jazz is increasing the amount of bass that they put on the recordings. I owned a recording studio for 29 years. I was subject to that. I had to replace my woofers constantly in my recording studio until I built a preventive device. But preventive devices are a good idea. First, you should do what Arlene says, but I think you should start with your neighbor. Talk to your neighbor first before you go to the landlord, the managing agent. Right, Arlene?
Yes, talk to your neighbor, but do it politely. I always say talk to your neighbor. In many cases, people do respond. But if the neighbor does not respond, and that's when I get those cases, they contact Grow NYC, then you have to talk to your landlord. And in terms of bass, I want people to understand those sounds affect the body. We're not just talking about noise. We're talking about a pollutant that is intrusive on the person's body, and it affects health and well-being. So it isn't just a matter, oh, let's get used to the noise. And by the way, we don't get used to it, we adapt, and that uses energy, and that's an expense to the body. Noise is a hazard. Noise is harmful to health and well-being. It's not Arlene Bronsaf saying it. It's the World Health Organization, and literature abounds on the detrimental effects of noise to our health and well-being.
Alan?
Well, I would also say that if you don't get a response that's satisfactory from the people you talk to about it, then you have to basically prove that you have the problem. And that's why a lot of people call me to make these clandestine recordings that I make in people's apartments, not just of noise from bass, but noise from pounding footsteps, garbage chutes, elevators, etc.
And how about things that people can do to muffle the sound or reduce, you know, how much the sound comes into your apartment from their apartment? For example, having two kids growing up who played the piano and living in apartment buildings, mm-hmm. I learned that one thing that's good for us to do as responsible citizens is put a few layers of carpeting underneath the piano.
Right.
And we also put a futon behind the piano, between the piano and the wall. And this is all to spare primarily the downstairs neighbors, because that's the way the sound travels, Alan, primarily, right?
Well, that's a very appropriate thing you did, especially if the piano was an upright piano. because
you
the soundboard.
The
soundboard is on the back. These it's vertical. And it's putting that futon piano, or something that blocks the sound.
My apartment isn't big enough for a grand.
Yeah.
You use the word responsible, and that's a key word. You know, our founding fathers were terrific. They gave us a Bill of Rights. But a civilized society requires responsibility. And I'm glad you used that word. But this doesn't, you know, there are other noises that are increasing in the city of New York that we have to address as well. And one of these that more neighborhoods are exposed to is aircraft noise. And that's the responsibility of the government. And they're not being that responsible. So we have neighborhoods now where the planes are flying much lower and causing much more harm to the people.
Really? You mean around Kennedy and LaGuardia airports primarily?
Yes. An airspace redesign program was introduced where they originally in 1999 said they'd come up with aircraft that would be safer, more efficient, and they would look at the noise. By 2001, the Federal Aviation Administration dropped that. So that people that are living in Queens and sections of Manhattan, Brooklyn, are finding it much noisier. And I have a daughter that lives in Queens. So I'm not just speaking about this as a person that just had someone call me. I go to my daughter's house quite frequently, and I'm going to tell you, the government has not been very responsive, and people are clamoring about the problem.
So, Alan, Keith Hernandez famously used to step out of the batter's box at Shea Stadium when a plane was flying over, taking off or landing at LaGuardia. If I remember correctly, Rudy Giuliani, when he was a candidate for mayor, criticized David Dinkins as mayor because he would redirect the planes not to go over the tennis stadium there, but he wouldn't do it for the Mets. More contemporary Mets players do the same thing that Keith Hernandez did. But when you don't have that luxury, when you're not a million-dollar athlete, Alan, and you live near Kennedy or LaGuardia Airport, short of what Arlene is hoping for, which is to get the government to do something, what can people do in their homes if they live near the airports?
Let me
ask Alan.
Now I'll tell you what I've done.
Before I answer that, let me just tell you that all airlines and general aviation as well do take into account noise patterns, and they try to mitigate the noise as much as possible. One way is to climb.
I disagree.
To climb as fast as possible, which means high power, and then level off as soon as possible at a lower power before they can get away from that metropolitan area. However, if they do have noise problems, people can install double-glazed windows, and not all double-glazed windows are alike. There's also a triple system that can be put in, but they're not triple-glazed windows. It's taking your double-glazed windows and enhancing them by adding an additional interior window. The various companies that make those, in fact, some of them are available for renters. They don't have to be permanently attached, so you can take them out when you move out of the apartment.
Arlene, what did you want to disagree with?
I'm going to disagree with you, Alan. I mean, I've been spending quite a bit of time dealing with the community groups in New York City that are fighting aircraft noise. I would love to be able to state, as you said, that the people that are flying our planes are so fully cognizant of noise and trying to lessen it for the people. I would gladly invite you to any of the meetings that I will be attending in the future so that you can have dialogue with the people who are being awakened at 6 a.m. by a plane coming over. And actually, if you go out to Rosedale now, you can practically touch the planes. So with all due respect to the fact that I do fly and I do appreciate aviation, we can still do it in a way that's less intrusive upon people.
I think Marilyn in the Rockaways wants to get in on this conversation. Hi, Marilyn.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. Arlene has been great, a great advocate for noise. I'm affected by the JFK noise and the flights coming over my house sometimes exceed 100 decibels. And JFK has flights 24 hours a day. We get a lot of overnight cargo flights, which affect different areas. It affects the Rosedale, Springfield Gardens area. Out in Nassau, they're clamoring about it, the Rockaway Peninsula, and people can't sleep. It has a horrible impact on our health. There are studies where it affects your blood pressure and causes cardiovascular disease. And so,
Marilyn, what are you asking for? Because the planes are going to come down over somebody's house. So what is it that you're exactly hoping for?
Well, you know, the Port Authority has not volunteered to do a Part 150 study. And thank goodness the state legislator passed the bills, and the governor actually vetoed the bill but ordered the Port Authority to do a Part 150 study.
Marilyn, I'm going to leave it there. And Arlene, in 15 seconds, what's a Part 150 study?
It's just knowing exactly what your noise problems are so that you can remedy them. It's actually just looking and seeing how the noise is affecting individual neighborhoods, what the levels are, and only then can you take action to remedy it. And we have refused to know what our problem is, so in other words, we don't have to remedy it.
BJ in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, BJ.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I know one of the recommendations is going to be to speak to my neighbors because that's what the call is about. Also, I'd like to say there's no victim and no perpetrator in this, just an unfortunate circumstance in that I'm a rent-controlled renter and the people above me are condo owners, and the several owners before them gutted the whole apartment, including the floor. I know the contractor who did the work. And when they replaced the floor and neglected to put in an acoustic barrier, which I believe is required by law, my upstairs neighbors, my newest ones, are not noisy, in my opinion. I just hear their footsteps and other sounds that moving furniture might make on the floor. And apart from speaking to them, I mean, I haven't done that, and I know that I should. I wanted to go up at a reasonable hour. I'm wondering if there's any other recourse, being as I'm a rent control tenant.
Do they have carpeting? Do they have carpeting? Do they have adequate floor covering? That could ameliorate the situation.
They probably would if they would do it, and I guess I'd have to go up there to find out about that.
I have to say,
at this moment, I don't know. A door person who went up there, I think he went up with the previous owner,
so I'm not sure about these. Well, if you want to contact me at GrowNYC, I'll work with you on it.
All right. BJ, looks like you got some assistance lined up. Alan, back to Kennedy Airport for a minute. You're a pilot?
Yeah. Kennedy, as well as LaGuardia and Newark, all have a runway called 22. It's the biggest runway. It's the one that points 220 degrees to the southwest. Airplanes for safety have to take off in that direction. Unfortunately for people in the Rockaways, it's pointing at the Rockaways.
Are you familiar with the new airspace redesign program?
Not at all.
I suggest you look at it. Look at it at 1999 and then look at the revised version of 2001.
Howard on the Upper West Side. You're on WNYC.
Hi. We have a wonderful neighborhood here, except for the fact that there is a nightclub across the street. And when the people are in the nightclub, it's perfectly wonderful. They're having a wonderful time, having a little bit of drink, not too much. But at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they say they are closed way before 4 o'clock in the morning, but it's 4 o'clock in the morning, they come out, and they are having a wonderful time on the street. And we have to deal with it. And they have their ears from the noise on the inside and a little bit of alcohol, and they're taking 45 minutes to say goodbye to each other.
So let's say Howard called 311, or Arlene, is that what you would recommend?
If he called 311, the police could respond to that. Does he get the noise in his home at 4 a.m.? Is it loud enough that if I had someone come in from DEP, I can get some measurements there?
Oh,
so
sure,
I could ask
sure.
DEP to look into it? Yes.
And the thing is, I do call 311, and I've even called the district, the police department, the precinct, and they say, oh, they never heard of it. Well, I'm the first one that called. And in the elevator in the morning, everybody says, did you call? Because I called. Everybody seems to call, and we seem to get no response whatsoever.
Here's the deal. Contact me at GrowNYC, and let's see if we can work on it.
Okay.
I promise your community I'll do that.
Terrific.
Personal service. Howard, there you go. And we've got a link to the GrowNYC webpage for anybody else who wants it now or later at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Do you deal with headphones and white noise generators and stuff like that, Alan? Is this within your area of technical expertise? Like, we're going to be talking to our next guest about creative people and how they like to work, either more noisy or less noisy. We're going to refer to Jonathan Franzen, the Brooklyn writer who once said he likes to work with a pink noise generator. What's the difference, Alan, if you know, between pink noise and white noise? And who do you recommend use what when?
Well, pink noise sounds like this. White noise sounds like this. Psst. There's a lot more high frequency or treble sound than white noise. It's not really a good noise source to use to block most noises. Pink noise is better, but it's still not good enough. What some people have done is they've come to me and I've designed for them custom what I call black noise generators. And the black noise generator produces a sound that is generally more acceptable than the constant bus idling sound that may be coming in through their windows. And they can control it. And control of noise is one of the things that gives people more ability to deal with the noise. So that type of noise generator is more effective, but they're not commercially available, unfortunately.
Are there any other color noises?
Not really, not the ones that are commonly used. But white noise is the generic term for any kind of masking sound.
Peter in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Yes, hello, Brian.
What's your question?
Oh, yes. Okay. I was prompted, thank you for taking my call, I was prompted to look up the New York law on noise after 10 years of fighting with my super, who lives on the same floor as tenants. And on a week after Christmas, he said, if I don't like the loud radio noise, call the cops, and implied that you can do anything you want until 10 p.m. Well, this, I'd like an explanation of what the law means. Local law 113 says specifically that between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m., you can't have a noise going into your apartment that's 7 decibels above ambient noise at 15 feet from the source, like if the radio or TV was 15 feet away from you. And between 7 a.m. and 10 p.m., the noise cannot be 10 decibels or more above ambient noise. What does this mean, and how do I measure it, and what can I do to say it's louder or figure it's louder or not louder?
You're looking at the New York City noise code?
Yeah, well, it said local law 113.
Yes, but remember, your rights in your apartment are governed by a lease. And the lease allows you requisite quiet, provided you're reasonable. And it depends less on decibel levels and much more on reasonableness. And if you're finding this is bothering you during the day, you're talking during the day as opposed to the night, remember, people work in their homes today. The world has changed. The computers have made it different because people now were in their homes when they were out working, so they didn't hear the everyday sounds of the children playing or the children crying. But life has changed. So I think you have a right as an individual to requisite quiet. And it isn't just a matter of decimals. Is it intrusive on your work?
Well, I'm retired, so I'm home much of the day now. And, you know, the super just does whatever he wants. At 9:30 at night, he's playing the radio so loud that I can hear it behind my bathroom door shut.
Hang on a second. Alan wants to weigh in on this, too, and we're running out of time, but I want to get one caller in that has an outrageous story that actually two people have now turned up with a similar one. But Alan, on Peter's problem?
Well, first of all, since you have a super who's making the noise, that's really directly responsible for the landlord. So that's good. Number two, you can hire a lawyer, but first I would suggest you write a letter. On my website, I have a suggested letter for info for renters. Send a certified return receipt, just like Arlene says. Complain about it nicely, but you should do it. And the important thing to realize is that the section that you're referring to is indeed, as Arlene pointed out, the New York City Noise Code. There's a section called 24-218, which is entitled Unreasonable Noise. And it's just one sentence. It doesn't permit unreasonable noise.
And I want to hear Sarah in Manhattan's story because it's outrageous. Sarah, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I live in the on the Upper West Side. I am well into my 80s. I have been living in a rental apartment in a building which has gone co-op. My husband passed away. We were a pretty good team, well known. I had a severe accident, and I'm somewhat infirm. I managed to get around, but I'm basically not well. What has happened is there's a new management, and they are harassing me. And the woman who spoke about health, my health has gone downhill because they have put someone in charge of ringing my bell all night into the wee hours of the night so that I cannot sleep. I had my bell disconnected. One night he came back, whoever is they hired to do this, and had his own bell, which woke me up. I am terrified of who's out there. This goes on irregularly, regularly.
Sarah, are you saying that the management company...
They're trying to destroy my health,
They want you to leave your... rent-stabilized apartment trying to kill you? They want you, or they want you to leave, right? Is that what they want?
Now that I have no husband with me and my health is obviously impaired, it's hard for me to get around.
And forgive me, Sarah, I'm going to get a response because we're about out of time. But you know,
two
people have called in with this story that in the other person's case, they said more explicitly that the landlord wants them to leave their apartment so they can use it for other purposes, and they're harassing them by ringing their doorbell all the time.
Let me tell you, this isn't unusual. There happens to be a pattern here of women who are single and older that are being harassed by managing agents and landlords. This is not a unique case to me because I've had several of them, and I will personally intervene on behalf of these people if they contact me at Grow NYC.
All right.
It's outrageous.
And we're going to...
And I've had it. I've had a number of cases like this. This is not that unusual to me.
Sarah, good luck. Contact Arlene Bronzaft. And Alan, who should contact you?
Anyone who has a noise problem that hasn't been able to resolve it through the normal diplomatic channels.
By the way, Arlene, did something happen in the last year? Because those stats from 311, in 2013, the number of noise complaints, 260,000, was 30% higher than 2012.
No, no, about 16%. They went up quite a bit. I double-checked on it. It was about a 30,000 increase. And part of the reason I got it as an explanation, because I already looked to hypotheses as to why. You now can do 311 online. The overall number used to be, several years ago, over 300,000. It's still the number one complaint, and to me, whether it's 260 or 230,000, it's still a lot. So the numbers have gone up a bit, but I want to know why. It could be because there's been the ability to contact 311 online. Mm-hmm, that could have caused an increase.
Right.
Possibly the noise that people are subjected to because of the rehab of the Brooklyn Bridge and not having taken some precautions to lessen the sound to the people living there. We have to rehab the bridge, but we should have been a little more cognizant of the backup beeps and using quieter traffic.
Yeah, so many complaints.
So that
complaints
may have done it. But the number compared
Brooklyn
to
over the Brooklyn Bridge
is down.
Thank you very much. And
thank
you to you both. Arlene Bronzaft, the legendary anti-noise activist and environmental psychologist, board member for GROW NYC, formerly called the Council on the Environment in New York City, and Alan Feierstein, owner of Acoustalog, an acoustics consulting business. We'll put both of their contact information on our page. You can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. Our family meeting, Our Noisy Lives, continues in a minute. We have some sounds of noise through history with David Hendy, who did a 30-part series on the history of the world in sound for the BBC. And he also wrote an op-ed suggesting that he likes to work in noisy environments, so stop trying to make it so quiet all the time. Stay with us. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer Show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's our family meeting for our whole program today, Our Noisy Lives. And now from the 311 complaints of noisy New York to a much deeper history of our relationship with noise and sound. David Hendy is here, former BBC reporter and now a professor of media and communications at the University of Sussex. Last year, he produced Noise, A Human History, a 30-part BBC series, yes, 30-part, that explores what he calls a social history of noise. There's also a companion book of the same name. And David Hendy, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hello, yes.
And listeners, hello. We're going to talk with David Hendy in a bit about the link between creativity and sound. He wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that some of you may have seen. So here's the question for you. Do you need silence to work or certain kinds of sound or noise? Are you the type who holds up and blocks everything out, or do you need the din in order to get the creative juices flowing? David Hendy has written a defense of working in noise, and we're going to talk about that in a bit. So start calling now about the link between creativity and noise or silence in your life. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I'm always amazed when some people say they listen to the show while they do creative work. Now, I could see it if you're a visual artist. If you're a writer, I don't think you could listen to a show like this. It would read as noise, I would think. But what kind of noise, what kind of sound do you like to listen to, if any, when you're trying to do creative work, whatever that work is? 212-433-9692. And while your calls are coming in, David Hendy, if we're going to do a little bit of a thumbnail history of the human history and the social history of noise, let's start at the very beginning. Here is early music expert Igor Reznikov singing for you inside the caves at Arcy-sur-Cure in France, where some of the earliest cave paintings have been found. So, David, did sound like that help you better understand our earliest ancestors?
I think so. And, of course, when we're talking about our early ancestors, we're talking about tens of thousands of years ago, we have to admit, in the world of guesswork. But some of it is pretty informed guesswork by archaeologists and musicologists who have explored the passages of caves like those at Arcy-sur-Cure in France. And they've noticed that those parts of the caves which are particularly striking for an acoustic reason, because they have very strong reverberants or echoes, happen to be exactly the same points in the cave where we find art, prehistoric art. And we tend to think of prehistoric art as something which gives us a clue to the deep, distant visual culture. But it's possible to think of these images of animals, they're usually animals, as kind of markers identifying places where perhaps echoes were heard, if there was chanting or some kind of music being performed in these caves. And you can imagine that, you know, when you're in an era which doesn't have a firm grasp on the physical reasons for an echo coming from a cave wall will sound in many respects like a new voice, a new sound coming from behind a veil, in a way, coming from another realm. So there is a you can start to imagine the possibility of caves being places where sound was played with and experimented with.
All right, let's jump ahead, 25,000 years, because you write a fair amount about ancient Rome, and it seems like it's the first example of what we can start to think of as modern-sounding noise. And I should say this is a reference to your book, Noise, A Human History of Sound and Listening, which is a companion to the BBC series. So describe what ancient Rome sounded like.
Well, it was pretty noisy, and it was especially noisy at night. I mean, you're talking about a city which, you know, was about a million people. I mean, it was the biggest city there had been so far in human history. And it was also a melting pot of a city. This was at the center of an empire, which meant that it was a city that needed feeding and supplying, and the waste products needed to be taken away, and people would come visiting. So there was a constant flow of people in and out. And the elite of Rome were very clear that they didn't want the streets and the routes to be clogged up with deliveries during the day. So there was, for many years, an order that deliveries would only take place at night. I mean, you'd imagine it the other way around. Now, if you were a citizen of Rome and you were living in the thick of the city, you therefore had to put up with deliveries through the night. There would be cattle that would be kind of ushered in and being pushed through the streets of Rome on the way to slaughter. There would be street hawkers, there were gyms. There's some very, very vivid descriptions from writers of the time about the shrieks and the cries of the street hawkers, and the yelps and the slapping of flesh that you could hear coming from gyms. So it was a kind of roiling, bubbling, babbling soundscape.
It's a fascinating description, and compared to modern urban life today, we did some comparisons earlier between the sounds of New York today and the sounds of New York in the 1920s with some archival tape, just as loud but different. And so you're describing ancient Rome. And I wonder if from your research, people always made the distinction between sound and noise in the way we do today, or if that's a more modern construct. And if people in ancient Rome, given what you just described, thought of silence ever as a commodity?
I think that, it's a reasonable constant through history that some sounds have been welcome more than others. There are certain, if you think of noise as a sound that's out of place, that's one useful definition. But another one of noise is it's a sound that someone somewhere doesn't want to hear. And you touched on this earlier, that actually noise is only partly about decibels and loudness. It is about a sound that in some sense irritates. And you can imagine that particularly as people live closer and closer together, jumbled up in cities through the centuries with less and less space, then the issue of other people's sounds becomes more and more of a problem. One of the things that I would say that is quite striking from history is that in many respects, if things work out and you don't have one particular noise that's dominating, and that therefore what you're talking about is just the noise of lots of people living together, but a kind of fairly evenly distributed noise, there is very often a tolerance of that. And what's interesting is that when the rich moved away from sources of noise, and in ancient Rome they'd say move up to the Palatine Hill, or in 18th century Edinburgh they'd move to the new town. When they moved away and they didn't mix so much with poorer people, tolerance decreased. In other words, mm-hmm. they got so used to quiet that quiet became more of a virtue, and noise became something that they regarded as vulgar and unpleasant, bit like smell.
It sounds very much like the modern world, and we'll take calls in just a second. Our lines are full with people wanting to talk about whether you like to do creative work in silence or in what kind of noise environment with David Hendy, and it's clear that you want to push back at the general sense that we have that the past was quieter than the present. And I know there's this really cool companion piece to your BBC series in which you asked an electronic musician to retell the entire history of noise in sound, and he does this sort of 14-minute audio tour for you. So we selected at random 3 points in the piece. Here is, from the beginning, prehistoric times. And his representation from the middle, probably around the 1500s. And from the end, say the post-industrial revolution period. The archaic sounds of typewriters. So what did those three taken together represent, very briefly?
Well, that was very much a mix put together by a musician, very much his own interpretation. But it seems to me that what you're dealing with here is a kind of, there's an eternal struggle as well as a benign relationship between humanity and natural sound. And I think one of the things that I think we were trying to convey in the series, that if you think of the noise of machinery, most of us can agree that a lot of that is unpleasant and intrusive, and we'd like to minimize it. But there is also a lot of sounds in history that come from human beings, fellow human beings, that have in the past been thought of as noise because they've been exotic or unusual or alien and mystifying. And so one of the things that we were trying to do, both in that kind of musical composition and in the series as a whole, was to explore the idea of trying to get behind something, a noise that seems alien and mystifying, to understand it from within. And therefore, in the process, it starts to cease to be noise. And you can think about this in terms of, you know, musical taste. You know, what we like is music, what other people like is noisy. And yet, if you can transcend that instinct, if you can start to learn about a music, you tend to appreciate it more. I mean, you know, fans of classical music say this: if you can learn about it, you can appreciate it. And I think that applies to sounds both natural and human, even if we can't quite bring ourselves to kind of really appreciate modern machine noise.
Jessica in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jessica. How do you like to do your creative work, and what kind of sound environment?
Hi, Brian. I'm a theater director, so I like noise that presses in, noise that can make the world feel a little bit smaller and lets my mind be a little bit more expansive. I'm working on a project now that involves sound in the city, and as part of that project, I sent out a questionnaire to friends and theater artists about how they work and what kinds of sound, how they feel about sound in the world. And it was fascinating. The groups divided pretty evenly into people who love noise, and to not have it, it makes them anxious. And then there are the people who just, it's too much, and they need something with a little bit more rhythm to it. And if they feel jarred at all, they can't focus. So our focus has been with this production, with State of Play Productions, in terms of finding out how sound fits into the muchness of the world and how much we pay attention to it.
Beautiful. Thank you. Justin in Fort Greene. You're on WNYC. Hi, Justin.
Hey, Brian. How you doing?
All right.
Good. So I just wanted to call in and say that I appreciate a lot of the noises in the city. I live downstairs from somebody who's a film editor. And, you know, I hear a lot of sub bass coming down from upstairs sometimes. I also live not too far away from Fort Greene Park. And their concerts during the summer. But I moved to the city because it's a creative place, and I wanted to be creative. And I'm happy that there are people that are here that are doing their thing. And if it's a little bit noisy sometimes, I think that's okay. I expected that when I moved here, and I think other people should expect that when they move here as well.
Justin, thank you so much. Dimitri in Ridgewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dimitri.
Hi, hello. I just wanted to say, whenever I do any sort of intellectual exercise, which is mostly reading for me, I love listening to music, but it either has to be really bad pop that doesn't make any sort of impression on me.
Huh.
It's just a rhythmic noise in the background, or any sort of chill-out electronic music with minimal lyrics. But on a few occasions, I've tried to read a difficult text while listening to one of my jazz or classical records, and it's a complete disaster.
So
it just doesn't work.
In other words, nothing
sort of
good.
Music vies for my attention.
That's great. Does that ring a bell with you, David Hendy, when you think about your own creative work? If you're listening to music, is it better if it's bad music because you don't get drawn into the content?
Yeah, I think that, you know, two of your callers now have used almost exactly the same word, which is rhythm. The music has to be rhythmic in some way, and this is, I mean, this goes back to the invention of background music, piped music. You know, back in the 1920s, when the French composer Eric Satie was in a restaurant trying to have a meal with his friend Fernand Léger, the painter, and was getting really irritated by the sound of the band. It was too intrusive. And he left that meal planning the idea of what he called furniture music, and he basically used fragments of popular melodies, but remixed and repeated over and over again. And that's what works, that kind of rhythmic music, because of course our hearing brain is constantly on the alert for something unusual and different. So when it kind of notices that, well, nothing unusual and different, it's kind of recurring pattern here, it can kind of switch off, that cocktail party effect of kind of acknowledging that it's there but pushing it in the background takes over. And when something is kind of striking, then that's when the problem starts.
Daisy in Nassau County, you're a writer, Daisy?
Yes, I write short stories, and I'm also a law student. When I am writing, I need a calamity of activity. So I have the TV on something that I'm going to ignore. I typically have something on the stove. I'm cooking. I'm also doing laundry. So I have the hum of the washing machine in the background. I have the boiling and the simmering of the stove. And something that I can hear, that I can be drawn to, but then I can also tune out as I'm writing. When I'm doing work related to my law school, I usually just have the television on, anything. And gradually as I'm getting into the text, I'll put the volume lower and lower so that I can sort of refocus. But I take breaks based on what I hear coming from the television. I do that all the time.
That
everything.
Is quite a cacophony. But if you're a writer, how do you write with talking in the background on television, presuming there's talking?
Right. It helps me. A lot of times, if I get swept up in the story, I'll also be caught up in other thoughts. So another thought will creep into my mind, and that will take away from the story. Whereas if I have the TV going on, I can refocus on that sound that's going on in the background without being drawn into it, and then I can go back to my story. It also helps me with taking breaks. I can be seated for hours at a time and forget that the world is even there. But I have a moment to then get up, check the stove, get up, check the washing machine, and then I can go back to what
wild.
I was doing.
That's wild. And you said you're in law school. How are you going to deal with the silence of the courtroom?
Oh, it's deadening so far. I've had that experience. I focus on different sounds. So I'll focus on the echoes in the halls. I'll focus on the calamity from the DAs, from behind the doors. So I focus on many different things, paper shuffling, pens scribbling on legal pads. I focus on a lot of different sounds when I'm in that environment. But I do notice that it is deadening.
Amazing. Daisy, thank you for your call. And we're just about out of time, but David Hendy, thinking about your op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, where you wanted a pushback against Thoreau, who went out to Walden Pond so he could work in silence, or Jonathan Franzen, who you referred to, who likes to turn on a pink noise machine so that he could write without the usual world sounds intruding. And you wanted to push back on that. And boy, it looks like you're in friendly company among our listeners.
Well, yes. I mean, I would say in a way I was quite sympathetic to Thoreau, because I think that one of the things I was trying to explore was the idea that, in fact, he didn't actually go in search of silence. He went in order for all the other sounds which might otherwise be ignored or overheard or missed, for them to bloom. So he could actually enjoy the sound of the pitch pines rubbing and creaking against the shingles and the cry of the birds. So it really isn't about silence. The thing is that it's about creating the space for a whole load of other noises, if you like, other sounds that we otherwise miss, to kind of have their day in the sun.
And before you go, in our last 15 seconds, as a historian of the world through sound, is there one particular moment in history you would most want to be able to listen to?
Well, I suppose I would love to be able to go back to the very, very deep, distant past. I would love to know actually what happened in these echoey caves. Are we right in imagining that this was somewhere where we can perhaps detect the origin of both music and religion through sound?
David Hendy, who did a social history of Sound for the BBC, a 30-part series, and has a companion book, Noise, A Human History of Sound and Listening. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next on our family meeting, our noisy lives. What happens when our lives stop being noisy because we can't hear that well? We're actually going to talk about hearing loss, including a story from several people I know with hearing loss who say they're surprised at how loud it is. Stay with us. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC.
And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
And we continue with our Brian Lehrer Show family meeting, our noisy lives. And so far this morning, we focused on the sound side of our busy lives and the emotional and psychological perceptions of when those sounds become noise. So let's talk now about the physical perception of those sounds, our sense of hearing. I'm joined for this by Eric Smuha, Associate Professor of Otolaryngology and Director of Otology and Neurology at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Dr. Smuha, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
And so I guess you're the guy who people come to with the opposite problem from everybody calling 311 with noise complaints. They seek you out when they can't hear or when the sound is inside their heads, as with tinnitus or tinnitus, right?
Right. So I'm the end product of that exposure.
And we've talked about how sounds have changed over time this morning. Do you have a sense of how the problem of hearing loss is changing? Are you seeing patients now more with self-inflicted hearing loss via concert amplification or too much time with the with the earbuds or whatever?
I think that's true. Although we probably won't see the end effect of that for several years until these people get older, until the younger generation gets older. But we suspect that increased exposure to noise through earbuds is having a damaging effect on the hearing, and the effect
earbuds. Can I jump in and ask, earbuds more than the old-fashioned headphones? Because certainly it's not new. Now it's iPods with earbuds, but you can go back to the 80s, and there were Walkmans with the lightweight headphones that people used to use in those days. Is this different?
I think so. Each generation has its own preference of how they're going to generate sound. But the problem with sound exposure is that it's cumulative. It's additive over time. And so and the other problem is that, sound energy falls off over distance, so that when the sound source is directly in your ear, it's more likely to have a permanent effect or a damaging effect than if it's far away.
Listeners, do you have a question for Dr. Smuha about the medical side of sound and noise? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And as your calls are coming in, we're going to try a little experiment, because we lose hearing as we age. We lose higher frequencies first. I've read that shopping malls have experimented with broadcasting very high-pitched sounds, specifically to discourage teenagers from gathering, without scaring away the grown-ups with the bank accounts. Do you think that's real? Do you know that to be true? Do you think that would work?
I think it's an interesting idea. Apparently you can predict somebody's age pretty accurately by their ability to hear higher tones, and it's definitely true that the higher tones fall off first.
So we're going to play three tones, and we're going to see if people can actually kind of test a little bit of their hearing, even hearing this through the radio speakers. So set this up for us. We're going to play an 8,000 hertz tone, a 12,000 and a 15,000 hertz tone. Would you expect that people of certain ages would hear one or the other or the other?
The older people will hear less.
According to the YouTube video where we got these tones, just to set this up a little bit more before we do it, Most everyone should hear the first one. If you're under 50, you should hear the second one as well. And if you're under 40, the third one. So here we go. So here's the 8,000 hertz tone. Listen. And the next one. And the third one. All right. So I don't know if you heard all those three down the phone line. I heard all three in my headphones. But as a sound doctor, would you use something like that in your practice?
Well, when we have patients with a complaint of hearing loss, of course, we get a complete audiogram. And the complete audiogram will test people up to 8,000 hertz. Beyond that, we don't generally test people, although it has medical relevance. It really doesn't have any relevance for speech discrimination or communication.
And your ears can't repair themselves, right? So what can be done as our hearing gets worse over time?
Your ears can't repair themselves, so the best thing you can do is try to conserve your hearing as much as possible. And there are things that we can't control, like genetics, but what we certainly can control is exposure to noise. And so in terms of what you can do to prevent it, avoiding noise exposure is the number one.
Let's take a call. Maureen in Secaucus, you're on WNYC. Hi, Maureen. What's your question?
My question, doctor, is if one were using earbuds, say working out in the gym or whatever, is there a parameter for how much time, say in a day, one should use something like that? Since it sounds as though it's detrimental, and one should limit the time per what you said.
Right. I think that all these devices have different outputs, so it's difficult to generalize. But if the next person can hear it clearly, it's too loud. I usually recommend to patients who ask me to keep the device to less than two-thirds of the maximum volume.
Less than two-thirds of the maximum volume. And if another person in the room can hear your earbuds, they're too loud for your safety.
I believe, yeah.
Tim on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. I have some special noise plugs that were I got from an audiologist, and they're expensive, and they were form fitted, you know, with a had to put a mold in.
Plugs? And, you mean to protect you from noise?
Too much noise. I moved into a very, very noisy apartment building last year, and I'm just curious if I have these in for a prolonged period, for say hours at a time. I mean, they're very, they help a little with the noise. They don't help as much as I'd like, but. They because they are form fitting, they're kind of uncomfortable in terms of the pressure, and I'm wondering if keeping them in for a prolonged period, like several hours at a stretch, is potentially damaging to my ears, to my hearing.
Doctor, earplugs?
Definitely not damaging to your hearing. I mean, it'll help you preserve your hearing. Damaging to your ears only if you're roughing up or abrading the skin, or if you have an allergy, and the clue there would be that the skin would be red and tender.
Other than that, don't worry about it.
Other than that, it's a good thing.
Tim, thank you. You know, I mentioned that I was going to ask about how hearing loss can be loud. I have had two different friends who independently said to me, as they've lost some of their hearing, one was actually born deaf in one ear, and said they can't believe how loud it is going deaf, which sounds so counterintuitive. But what they mean primarily is if you're in a restaurant or if you're in any place with a lot of people, it's so much harder to hear whoever is talking to you, whatever sound you're trying to focus on, than when they had full hearing or people with full hearing. Does that ring true to you? Is it in a way loud when you start losing your hearing?
I think that what people are reporting in that case is the distracting effect of background noise. So that when you're starting to lose your hearing, you lose your ability to focus sound. And if you're in a noisy situation, it becomes more obvious, it becomes more pronounced that you're having difficulty hearing, that it requires more concentration to focus on the person you're trying to listen to.
Judy in Westbury, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I was hoping to ask the doctor. I was diagnosed with Meniere's this past year with the classic symptoms. I lost my hearing in my right ear, had bad vertigo in the beginning. But now I've wound up with pulsating tinnitus that I have 24 hours a day. And I was just wondering if he could give me some advice on, you know, the latest advances or treatment for pulsating tinnitus.
Sure. Meniere's disease is a unique problem where the ear, the inner ear, starts to degenerate. And so what you describe is called tinnitus. The ringing in the ear, noise in the ear, is a byproduct of the disorder that causes the loss of hearing. So there are many different causes of tinnitus besides Meniere's disease. And the general advice that we give, first of all, is to avoid silence. If there's some background sound, it serves as a blocking of the sound that you hear inside your head. And for different people, different sounds work better to achieve this blocking effect. So that's number one in the treatment of tinnitus. The other thing is, since you asked about recent advances, it's possible to produce a hearing aid or a device that's like a hearing aid that produces this blocking noise that people can wear. And so we've increasingly had interest in this and increasingly dispensed these in the office.
Judy, thank you. We've got 30 seconds left. Hearing aid technology is really progressing, isn't it?
I think that's true. Hearing aids have gotten smaller, so they're less conspicuous. There's something called open mold technology, which allows the natural sound to flow through so that you're only amplifying the frequencies that are down. And they're digital so that they can be programmed for the exact pattern of the hearing loss, but also the programs, more than one program, can be stored so that programs can exist for noisy environments and for quiet environments. And lastly, because they're programmable, they can be adjusted or upgraded when your hearing loss changes over time.
Dr. Eric Smuha is Director of Otology and Neurology at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
And that's our Brian Lehrer Show Family Meeting, Our Noisy Lives.